Turning the pages, there is an illustration at the head of the story, The Call of Cthulhu, and a little quote, "The ring of worshippers moved in endless bacchanal between the ring of bodies and the ring of fire," and lots of naked bodies undulating in a suggestive but rather badly drawn way. The story, The Call of Cthulhu, has an extraordinary sweep all around the world. Poets and artists are dreaming this strange image of Cthulhu. It rises up in the collective unconscious. And one of those hot spots where it breaks out is in the mind of Wilcox, a decadent Providence artist. Also, the narrator of The Call of Cthulhu is going through the papers of his granduncle, George Gamel Angel, and he finds in a mysterious locked box a bas-relief, a rough rectangle less than an inch thick and about 5 by 6 inches in area, obviously of modern origin. Its designs, however, were far from modern in atmosphere and suggestion. Above these apparent hieroglyphics was a figure, of evidently pictorial intent.
Though its impressionistic execution forbade a very clear idea of its nature, it seemed to be a sort of monster, or symbol representing a monster, of a form which only a diseased fancy could conceive. If I say that my somewhat extravagant imagination yielded simultaneous pictures of an octopus, a dragon, and a human caricature, I shall not be unfaithful to the spirit of the thing. A pulpy, tentacled head surmounted a grotesque and scaly body with rudimentary wings. But it was the general outline of the whole which made it most shockingly frightful.
Here at the John Hay Library, we have a doodle, let's say, of Cthulhu, drawn by Lovecraft and sent to his friend Robert Barlow. And here you see the nasty tentacles, the nasty scaly body, and the rudimentary nasty wings. It's in profile, and it's clearly a representation of the text that has just been read to us.
Up until the teens and the 20s, there was a certain sort of stock of essentially folkloric figures from which horror draws. And you have the vampire, and you have the werewolf, and you have the goblin, and you have the ghost.
The British fantasy writer and editor of Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, China Mieville.
There's certain relatively stock figures. But with the First World War, everything changes, and these stock figures are simply no longer up to the job, because the whole point is everything is bleak and new. And you see in the monsters he creates things that have absolutely no cognates with what's gone before. In many cases, they're described as indescribable. Corpses and flies and octopuses. There's an explosion of tentacles in Lovecraft. Lovecraft is the high priest of the tentacle. And if you go into a bookshop now and you look in the horror section, every other monster has a tentacle. This was new in the 1920s. And that's why I think that what he's doing at a pulp level, this sudden newness of the monstrous, is absolutely part of the same cultural process that we see in the explosion of the avant-garde. The same social crisis that leads to Dada and this sense of the absolute breakdown of language, of every preconception at a kind of pulp level of culture, is what you see in the explosion of the weird tales of Lovecraft. It's about rethinking from the ground up and saying we do not understand the universe that we thought made a kind of rational order.
Lovecraft began to make confident use of real places as an anchor to his own fantastic fiction. He became adept at plumbing the colonial era, its history and architecture, to help make the unreal real to his readers. His engagement with Edgar Allan Poe also deepens at this stage. In The Shunned House, a story written in New York but set in Providence, a stroll along Benefit Street, known as the finest mile of colonial architecture in the United States, allowed Lovecraft to engage with his greatest predecessor.
Poe generally stopped at the Mansion House in Benefit Street, and his favorite walk led northward along the same street to Mrs. Whitman's home and the neighboring hillside church of St. John's, whose hidden expanse of 18th-century gravestones had to him a peculiar fascination. Now the irony is this. In this walk, so many times repeated, the world's master of the terrible and the bizarre was obliged to pass a particular house on the eastern side of the street, a dingy, antiquated structure, perched on an abruptly rising side hill, with a great unkempt yard dating from a time when the region was open country. It does not appear that he ever wrote or spoke of it, nor is there any evidence that he even noticed it. And yet that house, to the two persons in possession of certain information, equals or outranks in horror the wildest fantasy of the genius who so often passed it unknowingly, and stands starkly leering as a symbol of all that is unutterably hideous.
I think that there was a little rivalry between Lovecraft and his deceased predecessor.
The science fiction writer and Providence resident, Paul DeFilippo.
Lovecraft was not immune to that sense of trying to one-up his literary predecessors.
This is the house in Benefit Street, which gave Lovecraft the title for one of his most crucial transitional stories, The Shunned House. We think we're in Gothic horror land. It starts with stories of werewolves and vampires, but ends with science fiction.
The notion that current-day structures could sit atop more ancient manifestations of cosmic phenomena, I think, is a classic Lovecraft motif. You dig down as deep as the Huguenots, and there's more. You think you're at the basement, the metaphysical basement, but you're not. You need to dig even deeper.
How important is it that the monster is destroyed, not with a stake through the heart, but H2SO4, sulfuric acid?
Typical of the time, I think, is that writers had a sense that the old stake through the heart was no longer sufficient, that there had to be new methods.
It turns out that the narrator in the shunned house has really literally only scratched the surface. He sees a weird shape in the cellar, which, when he finally uncovers it, turns out to be the elbow of a really enormous monster.
Suddenly, my spade struck something softer than earth. I shuddered and made a motion as if to climb out of the hole, which was not as deep as my neck. Then courage returned, and I scraped away more dirt in the light of the electric torch I had provided. The surface I uncovered was fishy and glassy, a kind of semi-putrid congealed jelly with suggestions of translucency. Still more I scraped, and then abruptly I leaped out of the hole and away from the filthy thing, frantically unstopping and tilting the heavy carboys and precipitating their corrosive contents one after another down that charnel gulf and upon the unthinkable abnormality whose titan elbow I had seen.
Welcome to the famous Salem Witch Museum. We are going to show you the witchcraft trials which took place in Salem Village in 1692. Do you believe in witches?
Lovecraft's researches into the roots of horror took him inevitably to Salem, which today is crammed with museums, light shows, wax dolls, all commemorating the witch trials of 1692.
Long after Christianity had come, it survived in secret. On the witches' Sabbath, the covens of 13 would gather round their magic 9-foot circle, and the ancient ritual invoking the evil one would begin.
In Lovecraft's stories, Salem is often transformed into its fictional analogue, Arkham, a pulsing nexus of sorcery and superstition. An enthusiast for the culture of wit associated with the 18th century, Lovecraft viewed the Puritan obsession with sin as coming from a benighted age. As a native of Rhode Island, which had been founded in repudiation of the repressions exhibited by the Puritans of neighboring Massachusetts, Lovecraft speaks to an abiding, horrified fascination with the hysteria that broke out in 1692. At the Witch House in Salem, a period building used during the trials and the inspiration for Lovecraft's tale, Dreams in the Witch House, I met Bob Martin, a Lovecraft scholar who has devotedly mapped out the real and the imaginary places of Lovecraft's New England. The protagonist of Dreams in the Witch House, Gilman, is pictured as stuck in the attic right at the top of the house, a place
yes,
of crazy
the,
angles.
He's in the garret. He's right under the roof. There are no straight walls beside him except for the gable end.
He dreams a sequence of dreams. And some of them begin in a rather gothic genre, but by the end of the story, yes, we're into the fourth dimension. We're talking about things that seem to dip in and out of space and time.
What he took from science was a series of articles that ran all over the Western world about this scientist, an Englishman who had found a way to describe the fourth dimension and fourth dimensional space. And he said, well, it looked like balls of popcorn. And when you read Lovecraft's story, you'll find that the witch and her little familiar Brown Jenkin lead Gilman out of his house and into the fourth dimension, one of them looking like a ball of popcorn, only Lovecraft's term is a congerie of bubbles.
Two of the less irrelevantly moving things, a rather large congeries of iridescent, prolately spheroidal bubbles, and a very much smaller polyhedron of unknown colors and rapidly shifting surface angles, seemed to take notice of him and follow him about or float ahead as he changed position among the Titan prisms, labyrinths, cube and plane clusters, and quasi-buildings. And all the while, the vague shrieking and roaring waxed louder and louder, as if approaching some monstrous climax of utterly unendurable intensity.
This has to be one of the most emotive sights in American history. It's the room, in fact the bedroom, where Rebecca Nurse, old, sick, deaf, and completely innocent of any wrongdoing, was literally seized from her bed, dragged downstairs, taken to Salem, first arrested, then interrogated, and finally hanged for the crime of witchcraft. Rebecca Nurse was one of the central figures in the great drama, the great hysteria of the witch trials period of 1692. All roads for Lovecraft lead back to this place, because this is where America went wrong. This is where something toxic spread out. But it's an ambiguous darkness. It's still not solved. It's still not quite resolved what role hysteria, what role envy had to play in this unfolding drama of accusation and counter-accusation. And it leaves a dark cloud which festers in American history and American culture, in which darkness Lovecraft is able to draw the sustenance for the tales of the perverse which he's weaving as a horror writer and a science fiction writer in the beginning of the 20th century.
Back in Providence and living with his aunt, Lovecraft was writing work that was both forward-thinking and innovative, taking weird fiction into new science fictional realms. At the same time, he was also acutely sensitive to the Puritan past and to the origins of American horror. But he was also writing against the clock. He put off visits to the doctor, and his intestinal cancer, probably a result of the bad diet he always had, went undetected until it was too late to treat. He had changed a lot by this stage, even embracing a form of New Deal socialism. He came to favour the redistribution of wealth, though one based on the benevolent dictatorship of an intelligentsia. But there was precious little wealth to be distributed in his own direction.
Lovecraft regarded his poverty as a kind of a game, at least that's what he says. It was almost as if it was like a contest to see how little he could spend on food and still manage to get by. I have to believe that part of the reason why he didn't go to a hospital till the very, very end was that he simply couldn't afford to do so. He had no medical insurance, and they simply didn't have the funds for a long hospital stay. It is not clear what would have happened to him had he lived. They had simply run out of money.
With a melancholy timeliness, his cancer killed him in 1937, just at the moment that his dwindling funds were themselves about to expire. It was his readers, many of them fellow writers and disciples, such as the founder of Arkham House Press, August Derleth, who kept the cult alive and Lovecraft in print. The strange world of his tales would extend a hospitable welcome to younger writers such as Robert Bloch, author of Psycho, and science fiction luminaries like Ray Bradbury. After posthumously selling millions of books, Lovecraft now has the accolade of being properly edited as a modern classic. There is some poignancy in the fact that someone from the demoniacal pulps should be canonized after his death.
He was one of the greatest writers to emerge from the pulp magazines. In crime fiction, of course, there was Hammett and Chandler. He's the only writer of fantasy and horror to retain any sort of significance this long after his death. The real victory to me is that Edmund Wilson disparaged Lovecraft. He treated him with contempt and scorn. Lovecraft also proposed over and over again toward the end of his life that the United States publish uniform editions of its most significant writers, printed on Bible paper, with sturdy bindings, with satin strips. In other words, he foresaw the Library of America. H.P. Lovecraft is in the Library of America, but Edmund Wilson is not. I think that's revenge.
Weird Tales, The Strange Life of H.P. Lovecraft was presented by Jeff Ward. The reader was Jeff Harding. The producer was Paul Quinn, and this feature was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.